Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club. But we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Steph. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Nicola, Pat, Teresa and Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
This week on Write Club, we've got lots happening. We'll be discussing literature for younger readers. Pat is going to talk about portmanteaus.
Mm-hmm.
We're delighted to welcome J.A. Brunning, author of the young adult Witherstone trilogy. She's going to be reading to us. And later, we'll be sharing what books Santa might be delivering to the bedside tables of some of the children we know. But first, Teresa is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Teresa.
Thank you. Everybody got a pen and paper?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And remember not to shout out the answer.
Okay, miss.
So the first clue to name the novel. The opening line of this book is, there was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. No?
Nope.
Nobody's getting it. Okay. Clue number two. Eustace and his cousins enter a magical land through a painting.
Mm.
Oh dear. I hope somebody out in the ether is getting this.
Oh, I've read so many children's books and that's not ringing any bells at all.
Okay, yeah. Your final clue. One of the most memorable characters is a valiant talking mouse called Reepy Cheep.
Oh.
What do you think, Steph? Are you getting it?
Not for me, though.
Shall I tell you?
Yeah, tell us. Okay. I know the story, but I can't think of what it's called.
Well,
I'm sure lots of people, listeners, will have got it. The answer is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis.
Of course, yes.
It was the third of the Narnia Chronicles she published, though it's usually placed fifth out of seven in modern collections, which use Narnian historical chronology.
I did wonder when he went through the painting.
Yes, I did.
And I thought, you know, wardrobe, painting.
And I have read all the Narnians, but
so have I, loads
one.
Of times.
Yeah. Loads oh, well, there you go.
So, dear, that anybody, makes us look all a bit lowbrow, doesn't it?
Have you not read the Narnia books or never read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe?
No, I haven't.
You haven't?
Are you sure? It's so
Linda.
Wonderful.
But there was a movie, was there not a movie?
Yeah, there were
several movies.
Yeah, I saw the movie, I haven't seen it. So apparently I must read the book way all of you sign.
The Lion made a really big impact on me. I mean, obviously, the adventure of... he had such presence in the books, didn't he?
He did.
I'm not sure that the films captured that.
Oh, yeah?
I saw the RSC Christmas production of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe at Stratford. That was fabulous.
Yeah,
absolutely was amazing. Fabulous.
Well, talking about children's literature, in the Narnia Chronicles is probably one of the most memorable, and if only Linda hasn't read it... But we couldn't get it in your clues, so that makes us...
No, I don't think so. It's just most people, you know, well, one, you don't necessarily remember the opening line of a book you read when you were 9, 10 years old.
I didn't remember the names or...
Yeah.
I did remember Eustace. But Reepicheek was, but I couldn't remember the name of it, so...
Well, I thought that in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, maybe it's the difference between the movie and the book, but I thought they entered this magical world through the wardrobe.
They did.
That's book one.
It's book two.
Book one in terms of publishing,
book two in terms of the chronology,
Okay.
So who else had a favourite book from childhood? Nicola,
where do I start? I mean, so many books. Love the Narnian Chronicles. Loved anything with a bit of fantasy in it at all. I read all of the Famous Five, the Secret Seven, the Chalet Schoolgirls.
Enid Blyton was my guilty secret because my father didn't think she was worthy.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of read her. Well, no, she wasn't. But she published 600 books.
What makes a writer worthy or not worthy, you know?
Exactly. Enid Blyton is the author that children choose.
Yeah.
And I was lucky because my parents didn't didn't know it was supposedly rubbish. So I was fine. My parents didn't know anything about books, so that was good.
And I ploughed through The Hobbit when I was a kid, and then Lord of the Rings. I mean, as I said in the introduction when we first started, I just read my way through an entire library, children's library. I had nothing else to do in those days.
And my father was always pushing Arthur Ransom, and which I loved. I mean, Swallows and Amazons and...
Yeah,
going to see and all of those, but Arthur Ransom and Richmore Crompton. Do you remember the William book?
Oh, yes, William.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did anybody read Billy Bunter?
Absolutely,
yeah, Frank Richards.
Yes, and that's totally unfashionable now. But yeah. I read a lot of Billy Bunter.
Terribly politically incorrect.
I suspect they are. But they were great. I'd be interested to read them again or one again and see.
And then, of course, we mentioned the other week, Louisa May Alcott. I mean, Little Women.
Yes.
Those books just really transfixed me.
Mm. Oh, but I was so angry.
Well,
Lawrence married what's-her-face,
Amy. Amy, I know. What's that all about? What's wrong with him?
And Joe ended up marrying that.
The German with the beard.
Oh.
Yeah. But he was kind so and wrong. Lovely and they were in love. Yeah, but he wasn't the same.
Did anybody read the Little House on the Prairie books? Little House in the Big Woods, House on the Prairie and so on. I didn't read them as a child, but I read them with my children. Mm. And forget the TV series. They're actually very, very good.
Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yeah. And she obviously had an astonishing memory for detail, but one of the reasons I suspect, because they're true, but was that her sister went blind and she was told that she was Mary's eyes and she had to tell her everything and take note of everything. So she presumably this helped her visual memory. But they're really great books, you know, of adventure, you know, real life adventure, travelling across Perry, setting at home. And Pa always wants to keep moving west and Ma wants to be settled where there's a school.
Yeah. Linda, you've been quite quiet. Did you not read as a child? Oh, no, it was only the Bible, wasn't it?
I think a few weeks ago I told you the only book in our house was the Holy Bible, King James Version. But I love, as I said, the books that I got from school, particularly Louisa May Alcott and other little biographies. But as we spent so much time on the Bible then, not now, I remember the story. My favorite story was the one of the friendship between David and Jonathan, I don't remember now who Jonathan was. He was friend of David's.
Is this in the Bible, is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes, Nicola.
There are good stories in the Bible.
Kicked out of Sunday school very early.
Oh, I was going to say, did they have the Bible in Britain? Yes.
What do you think King James was king of?
Oh, my gosh, no.
No, my favourite Bible story was the story of Esther.
Oh,
you remember Esther, who ran in to see the king when she wasn't, because you weren't supposed to go to the king, and she went to the king, and she could have been beheaded because of it. But
it's those strong
women,
independent women.
Yeah, definitely. I also liked Anne of Green Gables with red hair and freckles. Yeah. She was great, wasn't she? In Black Beauty.
Oh, Black Beauty was
great. The Water Babies.
Oh, love the Water Babies.
Oh, I hated the Water Babies. Oh, I loved it. God, I hated the Water Babies. Yes. I had an aunt who, every Christmas, because she knew I loved to read, I knew that one of my presents would always be, I can't remember, was it Collins? But there was a series of hardback children's classics.
Yeah.
Always with the sort of brightly coloured pictures on the front. And I think that was one of the ones that she bought me. But most of my sort of classic children's fiction came from her Christmas presents.
But nobody's mentioned The Secret Garden.
Oh,
yes.
Surely that's, you know, a favourite.
And The Little Princess.
Yes.
And all, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, loved all
well,
those.
Well, and of course, Alice in Wonderland.
I was going to say
one
that.
Of my
yeah,
favourite.
I'm probably never one very of keen on those. They were a bit freaky time. For me. Oh, bit, a bit surreal. Yeah.
You know, I still haven't read Alice in
Wonderland. You've got a lot of Bible times.
It's an interesting thing because the classic books, I didn't read as a child. I've read them as an adult, as a parent. And also, going back to The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which was one of my favourite books as a child, and perhaps I didn't have a lot of books, I read it over and over, and that opening sentence stayed with me. But when I read it to my children, I was appalled, because in the first two pages, he slags off feminists, vegetarians, and pacifists. But the thing that it made me realise is, that didn't make me into a right-wing bigot, even though I read that
or
book.
A vegetarian.
Or a vegetarian. Yeah. Even though I read that book over and over again.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, as parents and grandparents, perhaps we worry too much about getting the correct books for kids. And letting kids read and enjoy what they enjoy. Yeah. Because, you know,
yeah.
And that certainly, obviously, Roald Dahl, I'm a bit too old for Roald Dahl, but I loved reading the Roald Dahl books to my children, and some of them are quite dark.
Oh, yes, they're brilliant. And that's why the kids dark. Love them.
Mm. Yeah. It helps them make sense of things they're afraid
of. Matilda with the, you know, the headmistress that throws children around by their plaits.
Oh. Kind of a particular thing, role model of mine.
Well, as a teacher,
yes.
Well, just to try to redeem myself a little, I'll let you know that I do have Alice in Wonderland on my Kindle, and I promised my stepdaughter, who read it all on her phone, that I would read it.
Read it, good.
And so I will.
You'll enjoy
good. The other books I used to love was, and my favourite book of all time probably, was my copy of A Child's Garden of Verses, Robert Louis Stevenson, and I still can quote whole pages from that
swathes
book
of it.
I loved that.
The Land of Counterpane.
Yeah, The Pleasant Land of Counterpane. Yeah. When I am grown to man's estate, I shall be very proud and great, and tell the other girls and boys not to meddle with my toys. All sorts, lovely. Poems.
And then we went to school and we were given books that we were supposed to read in class with the other children, and they were all so slow.
Janet.
And I'd read.
And John.
Well, I could read before.
I didn't like Sambo.
So, you know, I was.
I don't ever remember reading.
Well, I do. In the 60s, we had the Black Sambo.
I read that at school.
Yeah. I was too young to read that.
Yeah. We did Black Beauty. I remember Black Beauty.
Yes, that was on the curriculum. Yes.
Stereotypes of the staff.
Yeah, actually, it's probably a good time to change the subject and move on. Yeah, we'll edit this out. It's probably a good time to move on and change the subject. Pat, portmanteaus.
Yeah, so we're not really changing the subject too much because we're moving from talking about children's writers, including Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland, to portmanteaus, which actually come to us from Lewis Carroll, though it's actually from Through the Looking Glass, not Alice itself. But this came to me because I was thinking, you can't move at the moment without coming across the term Brexit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that was coined almost out of thin air, wasn't it?
Sort of,
I don't know.
And it's probably in the dictionary this year.
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. And whether that was before or after the referendum on whether Britain should exit the EU, I don't know. But I think we all understood how the word was formed. Britain exits, gave us Brexit. And they talk about Grexit as well, don't they?
And that's a portmanteau, is it?
And that is a portmanteau. It's a word which is formed as a combination of two other words.
So like Brangelina.
Yeah.
For Brad Pitt.
My children would call it a mush-up.
Yeah.
Well, you could educate them.
You rolled your eyes horribly.
Yep.
It's a mush-up, isn't it?
Well, I have to admit, I thought a portmanteau was a suitcase.
Well, it was. And that's how the word came.
Oh,
let me explain, right? The term came from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, which was actually a sequel to Alice's adventures in Wonderland. And back then, a portmanteau was a suitcase, and it was one that opened into two sections. But you're aware of the Jabberwocky, the poem in Linda Wilmley?
Yeah.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Since being an adult, I've had a little better education from children, etc.
Oh, good. So in the Jabberwocky, it's full of Lewis Carroll's nonsense words, but an Alice ends up talking to Humpty Dumpty and saying that she doesn't really understand the meanings of some of the words, and he tries to explain some of the made-up words, including slithy.
Mm.
And he explains slithy means lithe and slimy, and lithe is the same as active. You see, it's like a portmanteau. There are two meanings packed up into one word.
Okay.
And so a portmanteau being a case where you had two separate sections. That fitted. So now, if you go to a dictionary, you're probably more likely to see the first definition as being that of a word that combines two other words rather than talk about a sort of case that nobody really refers to anymore. One of the sort of the most popular, long-lasting ones that came from Jabberwocky, I think, would be chortle.
Mm.
I'm sure there are lots of people who don't realise that chortle was a portmanteau, that it was a made-up word, that it's not something that's, you know, somehow derived from ancient Greek or Latin.
So what does chortle mean?
Well, it could be a combination of chuckle and snort.
And we've all done that.
We have. Yes.
Because if you think about it, when you talk about people chortling, it's a sort of suppressed
snorty chuckle.
Well, you know, when I hear the word chortle, I think of Les Dawson, because he used to go yah 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 yah. That's not a snort, is it? That's not a snort at all.
No, that's not.
So, but meanings
it expands. They evolve and they expand. I think another one, he coined galumph.
Yes.
Ah. And
my mother used to love that.
She said it's a lovely word.
When I came downstairs, you'd get galumphing great
elephant. Yeah, we tend to...
How to make you feel very feminine. You might feel swoop.
Yeah, well, that's what mothers are supposed to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Right.
So I think, yes, these days we tend to think of galumphing as meaning sort of heavy and lumbering.
Mm.
But if you think about it as a portmanteau, it was probably lighter than that, more celebratory. So it's
galloping,
possibly
triumph.
Gallop and triumph. Yeah.
Ah.
So you were galloping triumphantly down the stairs.
I was.
You galumph you. So
if you think about as a kid doing, you know, gallopy gallopy.
Yeah.
And you sort of lifted your legs up.
Yeah.
Pranced almost.
I wish we had video of this. She's doing it.
Yeah, she should be a video podcast.
So, but now we just form portmanteaus without even really thinking about it. I mean, Steph mentioned Brangelina. We talk about brunch, breakfast, lunch thing, bromance. Glamping.
Glamping is one of my favourites.
Chillax, definitely.
I haven't heard that one.
Glamping is glamorous camping.
Glamorous camping?
If you go to Glastonbury and pay over £1,000, you can have, in fact, they range from £1,000 to
£10,000. Yeah.
Oh, you can have a very glamorous camping experience.
You can have an ensuite.
A hot tub, an ensuite hot tub, in fact.
Yeah. Or yurt.
When I went camping, the tent collapsed.
Not glamorous at all, then?
No.
And what about guesstimate?
Yes. I don't like that one.
Chocoholic?
Yes.
All right.
Workaholic?
They're all portmanteaus.
Yeah.
So it's just another example, isn't it, of the language.
So did nobody do it before Lewis Carroll? Or is it just that we remember him for it?
I would suspect that if you trawl through some of Shakespeare's, you'd probably find a few that you could.
Because there were so many new coinages in Shakespeare. I can't think off the top of my head.
I can't think of anything.
As you say, Lewis Carroll put a name to it.
Yeah.
celebrated it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's fabulous. Well, we've learned something today, haven't we, ladies?
Well, I have an education, yeah. I thought it was still just a suitcase. Well. So I'll use that word more often, and people will think I'm very
erudite. Yeah. And there's another good word.
Brilliant.
Erudite.
Right, well, we're going to move on now. We're very lucky to welcome J.A. Brunning to Write Club, the podcast, and she is going to read from her young adult Witherstone trilogy, from the first book, Witherstone. But before we hear, let me just tell you a little bit about her. J.A. Brunning grew up in Leicestershire in England. That is Linda.
Okay.
She spent several years in Norfolk, which is on the east, you know, the lumpy bit. Norfolk, Virginia. Norfolk, which is on the lumpy bit.
Top right of London.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Near London, yeah. From America. She spent several years in Norfolk, and she's now based in Lancashire, which is kind of on the top left-hand side of the country of England. Okay. Her first novels are the Witherstone trilogy, which is set in the 17th century, just after the English Civil Wars. When she's not writing and making things up, she spends most of her time with freelance creative writing workshops. She delivers them and runs them. She's involved in lots of writing and reading development projects across Lancashire and the northwest of England, including mentoring and critique. Now, we're going to put the links to her website on the resources for Write Club, the podcast, so you'll be able to access them. J.A. Brunning was formerly the project coordinator for the Lancashire Writing Hub in the northwest of England, and she's been a university lecturer teaching English literature and creative writing courses. She's also written short stories, and she's written a play about Pre-Raphaelite artists, which you'd like, wouldn't you? Yes. Yeah. And she also keeps bees, but she says she has no plans to give away any of their secrets. So let's listen now to her reading from Witherstone. This story is told from the point of view of Eppie Cresswell, who is a young girl who lives with her family. And she, in this section, she's just made a very perilous journey to see a herbalist because her sister Catherine is ill and they need medicine. But she's had to make this journey in secret because it's quite frowned on by the community to visit this particular lady. So let's listen to her now.
As the old woman lit the candles, all the light in the room seemed to be drawn into the table's rough circle, despite the bright sunlight streaming through the window. The surrounding walls melted away into the shadows, and the candles drew my eyes to their flame, and I stared at them, unblinking. The old woman turned towards me. "Well, are you staying, or are you going?" I turned to look at her. My head felt heavy, and the pungent aroma of the incense drifted around me. But I can't go till you've made the cure for Catherine." The crow's shadow suddenly filled the room as the bird appeared at the window, seeming to make the candlelight brighter still. Then he hopped past me onto the table. I looked at the crow and at the old woman's black eyes. "Well then," she rasped as I remained slumped against the wall. "You stay in then, I take it." And her ancient face grinned humorlessly. "Touch nothing and say nothing, and you can't leave, no matter what you think you may hear or see." Then the old woman picked up the knife, hobbled over to face the hollow trunk of the oak tree, and began to mutter a strange incantation. I realised with a shock that the old woman was indeed a witch, and my body went cold. I wished I'd realised what she'd meant about me leaving. I thought she'd meant having to set off back home to Witherstone, not leaving her dank cave while she did this. The witch had finished her incantation towards the hollow oak, and was now walking round the table, the knife held outwards and pointing at the ground, her lopsided gait echoing my erratic heartbeats as she made an ungainly circle round and round the room. Her hoarse voice was still muttering a rhythmic pattern of words which made no sense at all. It was like hearing another language. The light from the candles seemed to burn brighter as the old woman's shadow moved across me. I shrank back against the wall as she passed. After three hobbled circuits of the stone table, the crow and I watching her progress round the tiny room, the old woman's chanting fell silent. Then she walked round the table more slowly, stopping at each of the ingredients and turning outwards with raised hands, as though offering a gift. She began next to me, cupping the smoke from the incense in her hands and releasing it into the air while muttering. This time I thought I heard her scratched voice say, blessed air and guardian spirit, hail and welcome. The fragrant smoke seemed to hang in the air, forming a long swirl which moved gently in the spring breeze coming in the window, caressing my cheek as it stirred before me. The witch moved on, raising the candle before the fire and muttering, and the flames brightened and sparks and grey smoke came billowing out into the room. She moved to the water, sprinkling drops from the bowl and casting a tall rainbow shimmer in the air, and as she raised the brown pebble at the head of the table, the shadows in the hollow of the tree seemed to stir in the flickering candlelight. In the centre of the table, a millipede coiled itself round and round one of the legs of the pot as it began to climb. The witch turned, placed her knife back on the table, and her voice rasped unmistakably clearly, "The circle is cast." I was terrified, but unable to tear my gaze away. The witch picked up the slender willow twig, and the crow hopped up onto the rim of the iron pot, his feathers sleek with a bluish light. The old woman reached above the crow with her scrawny arm, paused for a brief moment, then began to chant once more as she drew the twig down from the air towards the incense and briefly touched the swirls of light and dark honey close to me. Without pausing, she moved across to touch the chopped agrimony, moving straight on towards the tree and briefly touching the pulped burdock root, then back across the table to brush through the bread mould near the fire before finishing back in the air above the blue-black crow where she had begun. She held the willow twig poised in the air for a few moments longer, still muttering her spell, and then the witch began the ritual once more, passing to each of the ingredients in turn, her chanting growing more insistent, hoarse whispers filling the room. The rhythmic words and movements seemed to go on and on. Strangely, my terror began to lull, and I started to feel like I was dreaming. Exhaustion washed over me, and the witch's voice filled my head. The incense breathed its heady tendrils across my face, and the candlelight flickered. The crow's blue-black feathers glimmered, and his beady black eye glinted, drawing my eyes into its depths, as it seemed to grow larger and larger, filling the room. The wavering candlelight above his head shimmered like a golden crown. The shadows lengthened, and he seemed to grow taller and taller, holding a gleaming sword in his hand. He pointed the sword upwards, then down into the iron pot, touching the shining black cups inside, edged with silver. He opened his mouth and spoke with the old woman's voice. "As above, so below, by fire and water, by air and earth, and by that which binds and holds them, I charge thee to banish the evil scourge. I charge thee to heal and mend, binding spirit to body and body to spirit. So may it be." The old woman was leaning over me. Her voice seemed to come from far away. "Ha, she's sleeping," she said.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Certainly was.
Teresa, you've actually read the whole of this book, haven't you?
Yeah.
What sort of age group is it aimed at?
I would say from about 12 upwards, mm-hmm. I would say, up to and including adults, definitely. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a wonderful book, it really is. And she has such a good grasp of the 17th century. Obviously, you know, she knows the politics and the cultural background very well, which does impinge on Effie's life. She writes beautifully about nature in the book. You feel very close to nature. But the thing that remains with me the most is how she writes about the love within a family, and that strong bond that holds a family together, an unspoken bond. You know, they're not saying I love you all the time, but that holds a family together through terrible distress and poverty and hardship. So I would recommend it. It's a really beautiful book. Mm.
I was very struck by the references to nature in that piece that we've just listened to. She talks about shadows stirring and trees and millipedes coiling and wonderful, and spring caressing the cheek. Yeah, definitely.
I like the setting so much because I could really visualize. She gave such good visuals. Mm-hmm. I like when the bird came to the window, and
yeah,
the candle burned even brighter at that point. But I got really scared when the millipede started.
Yeah, I didn't like that either. I was like, oh no.
Yeah.
It wasn't childlike at all, was it? It was easy to understand, but it was very it wasn't childlike. I think grown-ups could read it quite
scary
happily.
Atmosphere.
Yeah, very much so.
I think it's wrong to talk down to children.
Yeah,
I mean, I know that there are some things we don't want to share with them, but certainly I think the children's books I enjoyed, certainly as a child, were the ones that spoke to me as an equal.
Yeah.
Didn't try to,
patronise me
and protect me from realities. Mm. That was wonderful. Well, thank you to J.A. Brunning. As I said before, we'll be posting links to J.A. Brunning's books in our Facebook group. You just go onto Facebook and look for Write Club the Podcast. If you join our group, you'll be able to see all the links and resources to everything that we've heard and talked about today. And if you like our page, you'll be notified when each new episode comes out. So we'll look forward to welcoming you there. Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week, and normally we close by asking two of the group what's on your bedside table. But as most people cannot have failed to notice, it's almost Christmas! And we all know that books make marvellous presents, so we thought we'd share what books will be in the Christmas stockings for some of the children that we know. Now, I hope my niece and my granddaughters and my goddaughters aren't listening, because I happen to know that he's going to be delivering I Am Malala to some of them. I Am Malala is the story of the 14-year-old girl who stood up for education and was shot by the Taliban. I'm rather hoping it's going to remind some of the teenagers in my life that education is precious and not to be squandered the way I did, and that freedoms and freedom of speech are precious too and not to be taken for granted. Is there anything you're going to put in somebody's Christmas stocking?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so happy that one of my great nieces is now 8 years old enough to enjoy being read to from longer books with chapters.
Mm.
I've been waiting and waiting for the opportunity to buy one of my favourite books, Astrid Lindgren's Ronja the Robber's Daughter, for someone. Just, you know, look it up. One look at the fierce girl on the original cover will make you want to buy this book.
Mm.
It's nearly 30 years since I read this to my daughters, and I still remember the powerful emotions evoked by it. Born into a robber band, Ronja roams the forest hunting at will. She becomes friends with Burke, the son of a rival chieftain. When their parents discover their friendship, the children flee into the forest, because their parents don't want them to be friends. They flee into the forest, where they need all their bravery and skill to survive as they're attacked by harpies and other supernatural beasts. And like all children, Ronja suffers the pain of discovering that her idolised father is not perfect. In fact, he's a robber, which she finds really distressing.
Yeah.
She experiences the terror of being attacked and the love of true friendship. It's an emotional roller coaster and a wonderful adventure that I can't recommend highly enough.
Sounds great. Linda, are you buying books for children this Christmas?
I am, and we are fortunate to have our youngest grandchild, who's just turned 4, and I want to buy for her The Polar Express by...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Kristen Alsberg, it was. But, you know, and it's such a wonderful book. It won the Caldecott Medal, and he's won other awards for this that I can't remember. I bought this for my older grandchildren when they were younger, and I think that they still enjoy, some of them do, hearing the book. There's also a CD with some of the books that come around. But if you don't mind, if there's a little time, I'd like to read you just a thing. He puts a letter that was written to him. And he said, I get letters all the time from people, you know, and he's very grateful for that. But he says, one of the most poignant remembrances that was told to him 5 or 6 years ago at a book signing in the Midwest, on a snowy December evening, as I inscribed the book to a woman in her 60s, she told me that it was the second copy she had owned and wanted to know if she could tell me what had happened to the first. Of course, I answered. A dozen years earlier, the woman, who had no children of her own, befriended a neighbor, a boy of about 7, named Eddie. He would often cross his driveway to visit her. She had a collection of picture books, which she read to him, but around the holidays, the only story he ever wanted to hear over and over was the Polar Express. One year, she offered him the book, but Eddie declined. He wanted to hear her read it aloud to him, which she continued to do every year until he and his family moved away. Well, to speed it up a little, years later, she learned from an acquaintance that Eddie had grown up to be a soldier and he was stationed in Iraq. And she thought, well, since Christmas is approaching, she was going to send him a care box. And she did, including all the normal things, warm socks, candies, and cookies. And then she also put in a copy of the Polar Express. She thought, oh, it would just be fun for him. So after the holidays passed, she got a letter from Eddie, and he said he was very happy to have heard from her and to get the box of gifts. He said he opened it in his barracks just before curfew with some of his fellow GIs already in their bunks. A soldier in the next bunk spotted the book. He knew it well from his own childhood and asked Eddie to read it out loud. He asked, yeah. His buddy told him. Eddie, quietly and a little self-consciously, he says, read the Polar Express. When he had finished and closed the book, a moment of silence passed. Then from behind him, a voice called out, read it again. And another joined in. Yeah, read it again.
What a lovely Christmas story.
And the third one, this time louder. So he did. He wrote to the woman that he had stood up and read it to his comrades, just the way he remembered she had read it to him. It just gives me chills.
Yeah, that's lovely.
It's just, it's, you know, a bit of fantasy, but it's, the book is full of wonderful pictures.
Yeah, it's a great one. Yeah. Of course it is. Yeah. Pat, how about you? Have you got any children to buy for?
Yes, I have. It's a son of a friend and as a boy. Well, yes, he would
good.
Be the
I'm glad we've got some boys' books on the agenda.
And I can remember from teaching, parents were always saying to me about this, the boys, you know, oh, they won't read, don't read. What can we get them to read? Well, I think this solves the problem because it's become very, very popular. And that's Anthony Horowitz's series, the Alex Rider series, yeah. If you don't know it. They're great. Alex Rider is a 14-year-old boy, and I'm going to give Michael, I'm going to give him Stormbreaker, which is the first in a series, because I'm thinking if he likes it and gets hooked, then he'll keep going, and that'll be lots of reading. Anthony Horowitz, he writes for adults as well. He writes extremely well.
He writes for television as well.
He does write for television as well.
Is this the one? Is this the one where they take orphans and turn them into top secret spies?
Well, he is, and he's orphaned, and he's actually been looked after by his uncle, who he calls Dad. And the story starts with his uncle having been killed in supposedly a car crash, but then Alex, the 14-year-old Alex, discovers that there are bullet holes in the windscreen of the car. So that's obviously why it crashed, but why are the bullet holes? And then various strange people emerge, supposed friends of his uncle. And Alex is then, without really knowing it, he's recruited into MI6.
I've read some of these.
Yeah. And he has to then infiltrate some organisation, because without the information that he finds, if he fails, every child in England will be murdered in cold
blood. Oh, dear.
It's different. It's not the one I was remembering. So this sounds great too.
Yeah. Well, there's loads of drama and action and all the sort of spy stuff.
Yeah. Lovely.
There's
always
also, because there always is with Horowitz, there's also humour, and he's very much aware of his audience, and Alex is a very normal 14-year-old boy.
Right.
Yeah.
So we'll be putting the link to that.
Is that the age group that you'd recommend for around 14?
12 and upwards, I think.
I might try that for my, one of my grandsons.
Slightly younger than that, I think. Yeah. I think you can always go.
One of my grandsons is only nine, but he's already reading the Narnia Chronicles, so I think he'd probably cope with that. Yeah. Nicola, how about you? Have you got any children to buy for?
Well, I've got, as you know, late teens, early 20s, and they haven't started producing Sprogs yet, but so I'll look forward to that. But I tend to buy each of them a book, whether they like it or not, at Christmas. and this year I shall be buying them all, because they're all going out into the world of work now, and they're all starting to find out that the world doesn't revolve around them, and they've got to make a bit more effort to, you know, bring value to people, or they won't employ them and pay them. So I'm going to be buying them Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, which is actually a story written about two little boys. What they grow up together in the same area, but one little boy has a rich dad and one little boy has a poor dad. And interestingly, the poor dad is the teacher and the rich dad is the entrepreneur. And it's all about how they keep going to each dad and asking them about how money works and how business works and everything. And it's done in a really light way, and it's really easy to read. And I would recommend it to grown-ups too. You know, if people are struggling with their money, it's a fantastic book, because it really does explain how the world works and the world of money works in a very easy to digest story format.
Okay, that sounds great.
Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki.
And we'll be putting the links onto our Facebook group, Linda, so you'll be able to go and find out all about it there. I just want to mention one more book that I'm going to be giving. I won't say to whom, but I've already bought it for my 8-year-old granddaughter, Connie, for her birthday. And she and her 9-year-old brother love it. It's one of their go-to bedtime storybooks. And it's The Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls, which is a collection of illustrated stories that celebrate extraordinary women. And it's the work of two Italian authors, Elena Favelli and Francesca Cavolo. I'm not sure if I've pronounced that properly. They decided that there were too many books where girls were the hapless, helpless victims or princesses, and the boys were the heroic protagonists. And so they came up with this book of goodnight stories for rebel girls. It's quite unique because they actually crowdfunded the publishing of it.
Okay.
And it's a collection of stories that I think will inspire young girls and boys to be confident, dream big, and cultivate their strength. So I am going to be sending that to a couple of children, but I won't say who.
Well, that just reminds me of something that I used to love reading with my girls, which was Clever Polly and the Stupid Wolf. There were a whole series of books about Clever Polly and the Stupid Wolf. So, you know, in the fairy tales, of course, the girls are scared of the wolves, but this wolf is very stupid. And Polly always outwits the wolf. And I do remember one time on a train journey with my kids reading to them, in a crowded train carriage, and my daughter saying, "Mummy, why aren't you doing the voices?"
Fantastic. Well, we haven't talked much about our writing this week. We've talked a lot about our reading, but I think that's, we probably all allowed a few days off over Christmas, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're out of time. It's been a fairly bumper Christmas issue, but it's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We do hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review too. Have a wonderful Christmas. We hope Santa brings you what you're hoping for, but make sure the kids are out of the room for next week's podcast, because we're going to be talking about writing again, and we're going to be talking about writing about sex. And all that remains is to say cheerio and have a happy Christmas.
Bye.
Merry Christmas.